This is a studio version of my sermon for February 3rd, titled In the Details. Unfortunately, our recorder didn't work during the morning. And also, unfortunately, a studio version can't give... I can't come with a warmed-up voice like I do after Deborah's wonderful hymn sing, and we won't have the feeling that was given to us by Matt's wonderful rendition of Lake of Fire during musical interlude. But I'm going to do my best. Here we go. Here's a reading from Revelations 12, verse 1. I had the great good fortune to take a class on the book of Revelation, taught by the late Reverend Daniel Berrigan at the Franciscan School of Theology in Berkeley, next door to our UU seminary, Star King School for the Ministry. Dan was the first Roman Catholic priest to make the FBI's 10 most wanted list for his anti-war activism, pouring blood on draft records and smashing missile nose cones with a hammer, for which he served a prison term. After prison, the Catholic Church had silenced him for several years, forbidding him to teach or preach. His class on Revelation, the vivid, violent, and visionary last book of the New Testament, was his first official opportunity to teach after this silencing. Revelation is a favorite for many Christian conservatives who read in it a promise that their own tribe will rise to glory while all the wicked folks they despise will meet the same fate as the beast whom they dared to worship in spite of God's great goodness. Down to the lake of fire with those stinkers. Dan read the book and the beast in a very different way. First of all, he pointed out, there's not one beast, but three. They have a unity of purpose that makes them a kind of anti-trinity, a counterpart to the Orthodox Christian image of God as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The first beast is a red dragon with seven heads and seven crowns. He first attacks the angels in heaven. When they defeat him, he descends to earth to wreak havoc there. He makes a stand on the sands of the seashore, and now we meet the other beast. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads and 10 diadems upon its horns and a blasphemous name upon its heads. And the beast I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed. And the whole earth followed the beast with wonder. Men worship the dragon, for he'd given his authority to the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast, and who can fight against it? And authority was given it over every tribe and people and tongue and nation, and all who dwell on earth will worship it. Then I saw another beast, which rose out of the earth, and it had 2 horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence, and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose mortal wound was healed, and by the signs which it has allowed to work, it deceives those who dwell on earth, bidding them to make an image for the beast which was wounded by the sword and yet lived, and it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast should even speak, and to cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Also it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast, or the number of its name. Let him who has understanding reckon the number of the beast, for it is a human number. Its number is 666. Whew! Red color, horns, a wound that's been healed, the number 666, that's a lot of detail. But if the devil's in the details, I suppose that's where we have to look. Now, I wonder what the devil Matt's going to play for us. And Matt played for us a beautiful, beautiful version of Lake of Fire by the Meat Puppets. And here's the sermon. The four horsemen of the apocalypse, the seven seals, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, Battle of Armageddon and the rapture, the lake of fire and the mark of the beast, the number 666. The book of Revelation is filled with stuff that's familiar to us from popular culture like movies, pulp fiction, and TV shows, if not from familiarity with scripture. It always delivers. So if you want an idea for a summer horror movie, all you need to start the parade of blood and gore and beheadings of half-naked young people is an old-fashioned digital clock, the kind where the numbers had to flip mechanically. The camera draws our eyes to it as it flips to 659, but after a minute it flips not to 7, but to 660, the music shifts ominously. Now the camera moves around to various party scenes of young folks messing with drugs, fooling around in the pool, swimsuits optional, then back to the clock as it hits 661, 662, and so on before it finally flips to 666 and stays there, while maybe starting to glow red as, yes, all hell breaks loose and the usual sequence of, don't go in there alone, and is this the right time to start making out after we found that severed head, and oh, look, another body, all unfolds in predictable ways until someone finally unplugs the clock and shoves it in a box and the world is saved. Or is it? Next summer's sequel takes us back inside the box where the unplugged clock has started up on its own and now it's 6:59 again and counting. Hey, a lot of summer movies are built on even flimsier premises than my demonic digital clock. You can be sure our tension will rise as the time flips closer and closer to the dreaded 666. Everyone knows that number. Ronald and Nancy Reagan changed the street number of one of their homes from 666 to 668 because that looked bad, even though the house was on St. Cloud Road. House bills and highway numbers have been changed from 666 to something else, and some parents feared what would happen if their child was born on June 6, 2006. 666, sort of, if you ignore the other numbers. 666. But why is that the number of the beast? And why should it have seven heads? The two numbers are related. Both are associated with the Roman Emperor Nero Caesar. Rome is nestled in seven hills, so the seven heads are easy. The other number is a bit more tricky. Biblical Hebrew had no numbers, so a numerical value was assigned to certain letters. By one reckoning, the letters of Nero's name add up to 666. By another reckoning, the tally would be 616, but hey, that one doesn't pop as well and would never have suited the needs of pop culture. Of course I'm being silly. But Nero was no laughing matter for the early Christians. What kind of guy was he? Modern historians tell us that we should take a more nuanced view, but ancient historians painted him with jagged strokes. He was the last emperor in the line of Julius and Augustus Caesar. Early in his career, he tried to abolish taxes as a way to gain popular support, but soon ran up huge debts at public expense. He redirected funds intended for social relief into vanity projects like theaters and stadiums. He then used these as his own personal stages where he could step up as the star poet, musician, or charioteer. These expenses helped to bankrupt the nation. At first, his mother was a big supporter and promoter of his rule, so he had her image included with his on imperial coins. Later, he had her killed after she took him to task for one of his extramarital affairs. He also had members of the Roman Senate executed when they disagreed with his plans or decisions. Most ancient sources blame Nero for starting the great fire that destroyed much of Rome in 64 AD, the old line of Nero fiddled as Rome burned. They also remember him for gleefully playing music as the flames engulfed the city. They say that he set the fire in order to clear space to build a monument to himself, the Golden House, a pleasure palace with gardens that featured a gigantic gilded statue of Nero in the middle. He was determined to get it built at whatever cost. Like a luxury hotel or casino, the Golden House featured indoor pools, a private lake, and a domed dining room with a mosaic ceiling designed to look like the heavens above. It could rotate like the heavens seemed to do, driven by a mechanism that was turned by slaves. This mechanical hocus-pocus, combined with the colossal Nero statue, may have inspired the description in the Book of Revelation of how the second beast was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should even speak, and to cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. The turning ceiling mechanism could also drop clouds of rose petals, which suffocated one dinner guest when they all fell at once in a huge soggy heap. Much of the interior of this pleasure palace was covered in gold leaf, though I'm not certain if this included the toilets. The historian Suetonius tells us that when the Golden House was completed, Nero would say, quote, nothing more in the way of approval than that he had at last begun to live like a human being. Wow! It took that much golden crap to make him feel like a real person. Or maybe he was so sparing in his praise because he was already planning to stiff some of the contractors. He blamed the growing minority community, Christians in this case, for the fire, and had many killed in a kind of cruel public reality show, crucified, burned at the stake, thrown to wild animals. He made sure he was seen taking part in relief efforts for the non-Christian Romans who'd been left homeless by the fire, whose religion we might call state paganism, the official religion, backed by power. We're told that a year later he flew into a rage at his latest wife and kicked her to death. She was pregnant at the time. Some modern historians speculate she might have died of a miscarriage. Either way, Nero did his showman's best to turn her death to his own public opinion advantage by having her declared divine, declared a goddess, and burning Rome's entire yearly supply of incense at her funeral. Eventually, many leaders, including former supporters, turned on him and rebelled. He awoke one night to find himself almost alone in the gold house. Where were the guards, the usual lackeys? Convinced that he would be executed publicly in a gruesome manner, he decided to commit suicide, supposedly saying, "What an artist dies in me! What an artist dies in me!" But he found he couldn't do it and had to persuade his private secretary to kill him with a sword. You're probably sick to death of him by now, but no, his story doesn't end here. At first, his name was removed from many monuments in order to remove his memory, but later a cult known as Nero Redivivus, Nero come back to life, arose in the belief that he could rise from death and return, that he would rise from death and return to this world and make Rome great again. One after another, for over 400 years, men who claimed to be the risen Nero would appear. All of them were showmen, by the way, who used public performances to enhance their popular appeal. At least two looked like Nero, but none are reported to have the wound that was healed that's mentioned in the book of Revelation. That's a striking image, and I put it at the center of a paper that I wrote for Daniel Berrigan's class. I wrote, "The miraculous healing of this beast holds people in awe. I'm reminded of statements that we hear in seminary about recognizing that we are all wounded healers. Here in the beast, we have a healed wounder. Perhaps, just as wounded healers bring a special grace to healing, the healed wounder wounds with a special potency, infects others with a special virulence." Berrigan made a mark and wrote "good" in the margin. I treasure that page and all the others that bear his comments. But I want to stress that these wounds are not all bodily. What's astounding is that so many people longed for Nero's return, for the man who in their eyes had been healed and risen again from so many self-inflicted wounds, always untouched by shame or guilt for the many injuries that he had inflicted on other human beings and on society at large. On he would go, no remorse, no apologies, always beautiful in his own eyes, so deeply in love with his own image that others were drawn in too. Drawn in, pulled in, suckered. The beast causes, quote, "all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of his name." He has marked us head and hand. He engulfs us with his personality, his character. He has become our environment. He is present in every human interaction. The whole earth follows the beast with wonder, we are told. Suddenly, everything's done in his name. Everything refers to him. He has surrounded us with himself, walled us off from each other, and walled us in. Let him who has understanding, reckon the number of the beast, for it is a human number, and you know what that number is. This sounds like an invitation to add up all the bits of this complex image of three beasts in one, put it all together, and name names. Come on, people, the book prods us. Who does this add up to? It's Nero, of course. At least it was back then. Who would it be today? Is the book inviting us to name one of today's big new crop of strongman leaders as the beast, or Satan, or maybe Nero Redivivus? You know, the build-the-wall guy, maybe? Gosh, that's tempting. It really is. But the book itself warns us against doing so. I warn everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this book, if anyone adds to them, God will add to him the plagues described in this book. And if anyone takes away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God will take away his share in the tree of life and in the holy city, which are described in this book. Remember that holy city. I'll be coming back to it. It's easy to imagine that the author or authors of the book feared being punished by Nero. But it may in fact have been written long after his death, when his name was despised by pagans, Jews, and the new Jewish Christians alike. Maybe the book avoided naming names so that it would stay current. The beast is not one thing, one time. It arises at different times and different places, here and there. It arises at times within our very souls. And remember how we're told that the number 666 is just a human number? Maybe that means we shouldn't see the beast as a cosmic power just because it's so pervasive. Having a human number cuts it down to size and makes it manageable. It's not the alpha and the omega, the be-all and the end-all. 666 is sizable, but not really all that huge. So maybe it's best not to identify the beast with a particular wall or its construction, or try to drive that image like a wedge between our own monstrously damaged, monstrously destructive leader and his core of, quote, faith-based followers. But what about the walls of the holy city that the book just called us back to? The author of the book tells us that he saw a holy city coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. It is a city that has a great high wall with 12 gates, on the east 3 gates, on the north 3 gates, on the south 3 gates, and on the west 3 gates. And the 12 gates were 12 pearls, each of the gates made of a single pearl, pearly gates, right? And the street of the city was pure gold, transparent as glass. And I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is God himself. And the city has no need of sun or moon to shine upon it, for the glory of God is its light. By its light shall the nations walk, the nations plural, right? And its gates shall never be shut by day, and there shall be no night there. They shall bring into it the glory and the honor of the nations. A great high wall with 12 gates, 3 gates on every side, gates that are never shut by day, in a city that has no night. Do you think that it's a stretch to say that these gates are always open? Do you think that a gate made of a single pearl is a gate made to keep people out or to draw them forward in wonder? It's as if the wall is only there to frame the many gates. Do you think I'm pushing things too far if I say that if a city has no temple, for its temple is God himself, and has no need of sun or moon because God is its light, that the city itself might be an image of God? Daniel Berrigan wrote at the end of my essay an excellent, thoughtful paper. One cannot be neutral in the kingdom, only deceived. Thank you for your reflections. I don't know what he might have said about today's sermon. Probably that I was still being too neutral, though maybe not altogether deceived. What action are you calling people to take, Craig? He might have asked. Dan, I might have pleaded, I don't want to make people feel walled in, even here, even today, during our worship service. Then he would say, but if they're surrounded anyway, why not lead them out to witness against the beast? I'm sure I'd struggle for an answer. Dan, I don't think I've got it in me to smash missile nose cones with a hammer or pour blood on draft records or go to prison for it like you. He might reply, but what tools are you prepared to use? Well, I suppose I could try giving folks some points to bring up when talking with Christian friends or relatives or writing letters to the editor. I could try doing what you did when you taught us the book of Revelation, inviting folks to look for tools of liberation in a book that's so often used to oppress. In the whole Bible, I mean, not just the last book. I could also promise that I would never encourage people to take an us versus them attitude, but rather to try to see themselves in the details of the stories that they read, no less in the image of the heavenly city than in the image of those who are marked by the beast, and even in the beast itself. Who has never wished to impose their will on other people, or maybe on the whole world? Who has never wished for everlasting love and peace? Do we all not walk in light and darkness? Are we not enraptured by the beast sometimes, even as we stand at the very gates of the holy city? I can imagine Dan smiling his gentle, thoughtful smile and saying, "Maybe that's enough for now. For now. But be prepared for what comes next. I'll do my best. I will. And I hope that you will too." Amen.